Thank you very much for all those comments. Yolanda asked me to kick this off with a few questions, and then we'll take it to the audience from there. So I'm going to pick up on the last speaker and start with some other folks. First, Dick, since it's your paper, you get to just anything that you would like to respond to before I launch into specific questions. The floor is yours.
Thank you. Just a couple of thoughts, reactions. And the first thing, I certainly in suggesting that age neutrality was something that could be an advantageous aspect of plans, did not intend that to mean that there was a problem with defined benefit structures. The great advantage of defined benefit structures is that they are automatically annuitized for as long as you live. So you can't outlive your resources as you can with savings that aren't annuitized. The issue of age neutrality is one of sort of, I start globally, which is, we've developed a standard of living in this country that is based on a workforce, you know, with a certain number of workers, a certain technology, capital systems in place that produces goods and services that make our standard of living. When a sizable block of that workforce is about to move to an age when traditionally retirement has happened at high rates, that labor disappears from making the goods and services that maintain the standard of living for all of us. I mean, just the population as a whole. So it's those demographics that lead me to want systems that for people who are able. So, you know, again, I define benefit SAMs that annuitize the risk of living a really long time, disability insurance programs that make sure that people who don't have the capacity to work still have the resources. All of that needs to be part of the system. But for those who are able and want to, continued labor force participation to somewhat older ages than they've had in the past seems to me an integral part of our collective transition to a very different demographic environment in the future. So that, you know, that was the point that I was trying to make there. Not at all that we should be scrapping defined benefit plans and replacing with defined contribution plans. It's the character of the plans, the provisions of the plans and how they adjust benefits for retiring younger or retiring later that I think could be revisited to be more neutral. So I guess that's that's what I'll react with at the moment. I don't know if that was clear, but
thank you. I think that's very helpful. I'm going to move in because we don't have a lot of time before we open it up to the whole audience. So if we could start at the end of the table and move down, Catherine. We read about several policy reform efforts in Dick's paper, and two of you on the panel were directly involved in your states, and all of you are involved in various ways throughout the country and in New England. So give us your best advice, Catherine, starting with you. What are the two or three most important things to keep in mind if somebody wanted to be involved in pension reform in their state? And since I didn't have time to ask the other question, which is, first, tell us whether you agree or not that we need pension reform. And if we don't, then tell us why not. And if we do, what are the two or three most important things for all stakeholders to keep in mind? Is there some principles or actions that you think that have the potential to unite many different interests?
Because states vary so much, I would say that the answer varies, that pension reform and reform to retiree health benefits is necessary in some states and not in others. In some states, it's working very well. To me, one of the fundamental issues is the need for real honesty in facing what the ultimate liabilities are. It's important to know the numbers. My sense is that it was, for example, what GASB did, the Governmental Accounting Standards Board did in 2004 by saying that we should know what we owe for retiree health is an important step. The assumption should be honest and transparent, and we should be all working with the same set of facts, which is, you know, which shouldn't be that difficult.
My instinct is that the affordability issue. I think the affordability issue, if you look at what we faced in Rhode Island, and I would dare say you're all facing it, the amount of your pension contributions under the current process will be ever taking more from your operating budget. So you're going to be making a choice of, do I reduce my service programs, do I reduce programs, or do I raise taxes to fund a current pension system? And again, most of us sitting here have not felt the full amount of the market changes. I would dare say to you that most of you have had 1 year, at less than 1 year's experience of the market changes, because most of you smooth on your return. So you have not felt it. So all of the discussions so far on pensions have had nothing to do with the market collapse in 2008 and 2009 on the defined benefit plans, because most of you smooth out over a 3 or 5 year period. Your affordability issue will be more demanding as you go into 2012 and 2013 at a time you are unable to afford it. Federal government moves away on all of its ERA funding. You're going to face a fiscal issue next year that you're going to have to look at the cost of government. One of the cost items is pensions and health care. I didn't take much time. I have a slide that shows the full liability of pension and OPEB for the state of Rhode Island. It's $9.4 billion. It's $9,400 per person. We went out and did an analysis of all of it. If you look at that, we don't make our ARC payment, all of the ARC payments on local governments for pensions, and we don't make them for health care. If you're looking to go to do that, and what you're going to have to do it if you don't change the benefit side, it is going to take more away from what you have the ability to do your basic city services or state services, education, et cetera. So the question is, you look at the cost of running government. What is the one of the items that most looks at? And that's the cost of employees. 70 to 80% of budgets are employee costs. If you don't look at the employee cost, what do you look at then? Moving money not to local government? Where does that go to? That goes to employee benefits and cost of employees. So you're going to have to look at those issues, both in general. Next question is, one looks at what is the comparability, the competitive nature of a public employee versus the private employee. We heard someone from the SEIU saying that a majority of the employees in SEIU in the private sector have no pension. How many in the public sector have no pension? How many in the public sector, and this is where I mentioned earlier, I probably didn't say it as well, you're going to look at three pension systems. You're going to look at public safety, you're going to look at the regular public employee, and then you're going to look at the private sector. Private sector, the majority of all employers are now going away from a defined benefit to a defined contribution plan. Why? It's cheaper, more predictable, and less risk for the employee. More mobility. There's a whole different set of features. We suggested that you look not at a defined contribution plan, but rather to a hybrid plan. The federal government instituted one a number of years ago that is mobile, that has all of the component features of a defined benefit plan, gives you some idea of what it is. It's a lower accumulation rate, but you have a defined contribution, so if the employee wants to put in more, they can. That is very mobile, it's very movable, and it does work. Several states have gone from a defined contribution plan, did not work, and we would agree with that, to this hybrid plan. So without controlling the cost of employees, I think you're going to have to do something else, which, again, is what? Raise taxes. And in this environment, I'm not sure many in this room would be willing to stand up and say, we want to raise taxes $50 to $60 million just to pay for public employee, either health care or pensions.
I'd say that no matter what kind of shape your pension fund is in, you need reform, at least change. And I think, Dick's, the realities are that people are living longer, and there are more of them, and then it's expensive. And I agree with John that you got to deal with the fiscal and demographic realities, and they're there. And the federal government doesn't have a lot of money left, and we know the situation they're in. And if you're involved with paying the bills in your states, you know that you've got challenges too. So I think there's no question in my mind that changes need to be made, no doubt about it. I do think that we should be careful about throwing around the very large figures of unfunded liability without really thinking about what they are, because those are bills that are going to be paid over the next 30 years. And during that period, both the employer and the employees are going to continue paying in. So, you know, your unfunded liability, the difference of what your current liabilities are compared to what the assets you have on hand are, and that's your unfunded liability. But you're paying that over 30 years. There's a lot of pay-in on that. And I think that people can come to an incorrect conclusion by just looking at that figure without really thinking about what it really represents. The two or three things I think are important to keep in mind, I think I agree, you know, every state's different. You really need to look at the climate in your state. I also agree that you need to keep in mind that while I agree that a major challenge is retirement insecurity on a national basis, that what John said is accurate, that very few people other than public employees have these kind of benefits, and it's getting tougher and tougher to defend them. And if you are going to defend them, at least in my state, I had a hard time explaining to people how come people could retire and start drawing their full benefits and health insurance as young as 52 or 50 or 49 or 48 in some cases. So we had to, you know, make some changes there. I think if you don't, you know, try to make these things compatible with the realities we're looking at, it'll be harder to maintain support for them. I guess one other lesson, you know, on two sides. I think if you're going to be successful in making changes, some people or somebody's going to have to be willing to take some flack, because making changes in the public sector is not easy. That, you know, you ought to think carefully about whether you want to what you can do to avoid serious legal challenges. And there are a number of states out there that have you know, enacted or are trying to enact changes where they are subject to some serious litigation and may well not succeed. And that might make them feel good that they passed something that you know, has the potential to make changes. But if there are injunctions and they're not sustained in the legal system, they just lost time. In our state, the two most recent examples, although there, it hasn't been easy, and there has been some capital expended, I'm talking about political capital expended, I think unless you, it's much more, you might find it better to try to come up with a solution that both sides can feel good about and make some changes that give you savings right away as opposed to ones that may never materialize.
I mean, we are facing in all of the bargaining, I don't think there's a single bargaining unit that SEIU represents anywhere in the country that isn't dealing with this issue, and dealing with furloughs and pay cuts and layoffs. All the while paying in every 2 weeks that 5 or 6 or 7% towards the pension contribution. Our health as a union is dependent upon the health in the public sector, is dependent on the health of the agencies that provide those services. Make sure that we have an adequate number of well-trained, well-regarded foster care workers, hazmat operators, DOT workers who will show up on the freeway when you break down to help you out. Those are the things, the hidden things that we all, you know, sort of count on that is government. Government is the people that provide those services. We do need to recognize, obviously, that our population is growing older, as we have recognized this bulge of the baby boom at every opportunity since the end of the Second World War. We figured out how to educate massive quantities of new kids, get them through college. We figured out how to absorb them into the workforce, and we'll figure out how to get them through retirement. The defined benefit portion of it mostly works. It's mostly working, and it's mostly been working. When we look at it, though, I think we need to think, why do we have it? We have it for that retirement security, but we also have it to encourage the retention of long-term career employees. That isn't the dynamic in the private sector. where turnaround is much more prevalent, and perhaps other kinds of systems can make sense. I've mentioned a couple of the reforms. I think the tantamount one, the one that has got us in the most trouble behind the volatility in our economy, is the fact that in many states, employers have not made the contribution that they knew they were supposed to make, and found a reason because they were stretched to keep the libraries open or they were stretched to keep the schools open because they were afraid to raise revenues to cover those services. So, you can say that it's to pay the pension contribution, but it's really what we need to do is figure out how to repair the structural deficits that we've got at state and local government that hamstring those agencies for providing the services that people demand and expect but aren't willing to pay for.
Thank you. I am going to let the treasurer.
I just had one other thing that occurred to me that I think you ought to keep in mind. And it picks up on something Marguerite said, that the majority of revenues to pay benefits have come from investment returns. But anybody who thinks that the next 20 years of likely investment returns are going to be like the last 20 years ought to rethink it.
Thank you. Catherine, do you have a
just it, well, one point, again, stemming from what Marguerite said. We did a report. The Pew Center on the States did a report in 2007. It came out the day, the month the recession began. So it reflected some good years in the economy. And what we found was that states weren't paying their required contributions when they had surpluses. So that's something that I'm concerned about, is that if the economy gets better, will the contributions be made? And can we find another way in which we can even out some of the volatility in the economy, the volatility that affects states, by asking states to pay more when the revenues are coming in nicely?
CalPERS, California, which I know some people have derided this move that they've made, but they actually are trying to do that with the way that they manage contributions, with a 15-year smoothing period, recognizing that volatility. And they're on a trajectory to continue making, contributions. Well, there won't be payment holidays in California anytime soon, even if the economy goes back to pre-2007.
Okay, John, you got the last word, and then we're going to go to the microphone.
On the reform part of it, this sounds strange coming from an expenditure council. It ought not to be about just spending control if you do the reform, but you still do have to go back and look at it as a human resource system. You have to look at it as a human resource system when you do if you are going to do reforms and changes, because you do have to look at whether you want to retain people or you don't want to retain people. How long do you want to retain them? What is the in and out of it, because I think we're going through a generational issue. Most of the people in this room, except for probably maybe 10, would say to you, yes, I've always learned that I want to go to work for someone and stay there. That happens in the private sector as well as in the public sector. I think that dynamic is going to change over the next 5 to 10, 15 years. The people who want to come, they don't necessarily want to have to stay for 30 years to get a retirement or to get the larger increases, or 10 years as a teacher or 12 years. I think that whole generational change would make a difference in how you look to reform the system itself, because the defined benefit was constructed back 20, 30, or 40 years ago when we were looking for people to come and stay forever. And that may not be the same, and may not be truthful in the future.
So thank you very much, all of you, for your comments and responses and questions, and let's open it up. If you could talk into the microphone, staff will come around. If you don't mind introducing yourself, that's helpful from whence you come.
I'm Bob Tannenwald. I work for the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, an organization in Washington, D.C., which works on issues involving low and moderate income people. I have two comments. One is pessimistic, and the other is a suggestion for a solution. I think in Arizona, pension benefits are protected by the Constitution, talking about legal challenges. And in many states, most states, I believe, state governments are required to provide every child between the ages of 5 and 18 with an educable education. And I know that The city I live in has been sued for potholes in the road if they've resulted in injury. It might be a rather disappointing accounting exercise to find out in each state an estimate of what the state and its municipalities are required by law within the state to pay, and then what's left over. On the positive side, here's just a thought. The other flip side of this demographic change is labor shortages. And, you know, baby boomers who have retired, who are on the verge of retiring in the public sector, many of them have skills that would be useful. The nurse you refer to, if there is a shortage in any profession, it's nurses. And could, this was true in the private sector as well, could state governments offer their retiring employees a trade-off, which is, in effect, some leisure for, if they stay in the workforce, part-time work, and maybe they'd retire later, and perhaps this would alleviate to some extent the bind that states are getting into with their retirement plans. So, maybe it's not such a good idea for firefighters to be on the force when they're 60 or 62, or even police officers. But I know private hospitals have done this. They have invested a little bit in their structures to make it easier for nurses who have enormous wealth of experience, so that they don't have to bend down all the way to get the equipment from under the bed, but they put it on shelves on the wall. And maybe, you know, so that they work three and a half days a week instead of 8 days a week. And this might be attractive. They earn less salary. They continue to contribute somewhat to the pension plans. And they're, according to health studies, they're healthier, and they might retire at the age of 68. And I don't know how that all works out in terms of helping the problem, but maybe it does. That would be an interesting study.
Thank you. We did hear some the data on, I mean, on the one side, it's taking active workers, contributing to the system, and instead of them retiring and replacing them with younger workers that will continue to contribute to the system, in some states they're going into part-time, and it's not even really part-time. It's essentially coming back and not paying into the system and drawing down a pension. On the other hand, with Bob, and obviously that would not be a good financial perspective or help with the security financially or the long-term well-being of the workforce. But I think Bob poses a different approach to that with labor shortages. Has anybody looked at that in their states, or is there a positive, negative opportunity there?
Yeah, the pension system actually negates the crossing from the private to the public because of the length, the 10-year vesting. So if you look at turnovers of, and you'll be seeing in most states who have elections, a turnover in January, hiring folks to come in on the public arena from the private because of the pension is one of the reasons that stymies a lot of free flow of hiring, because you can't work for 10 years when someone has a 2 or 4 year term. So moving people over, and we look at the transition issues, that they are a problem of moving from the private to the public, but not from the public to the private, because, again, they have a different type of pension system. But the other parts of it is a training process of going in from the private to the public. So it is one of the things that, what Bob was mentioning, is that we begin to look at now, and we are going to look at the training issues for crossing over between the public and the private, especially as the baby boomers come away and go to do something else. And again, I would premise the argument they will do something else. They won't necessarily retire from the public and not be in the labor market.
Thank you.
If I asked some folks in here, there's probably at least 10 people who are looking to be retired from the public arena and are probably in some other job.
That's another difference between states, though. You know, and I know I won't mention Rhode Island, but in Massachusetts, for example, the state treasurer's office, everybody that works in the treasurer's office is a political appointment or subject to be a political appointment. In our state, I'm going to just guess of the total state workforce, it might be 2 or 3%. I mean, so there's not a whole lot of turnover there. I do think it's definitely worth thinking about ways to, you know, allow people to work part-time and so forth. Some of those things that have been tried in the past end up working differently than they were expected to. So I think, you know, I think it's a good idea. You need to, I don't know exactly how to do it without having sometimes an unintended effect.
Yeah, the issue of return to work after retirement or after retirement, I mean, there's more fundamental changes that need to happen to a pension plan to support that. I mean, it's part of the headlines that we get about pension abuse is, you know, people who are drawing, you know, a large pension and then coming back and getting paid the same or more, even at the same job working as a quote-unquote consultant. So, I think it could work. I think it's right to think about, you know, how to encourage people in needed professions to, you know, continue to be there. I mean, government employment is less than 10% of the workforce, public sector employment. Given, you know, the National Institute for Retirement Security's recent study comparing comparable employment, public and private sector, indicates that even with pension benefits included, public sector workers earn 11% less. I know this is contrary to everything you've read in the newspapers, but than their private sector counterparts. So I think there are some, you know, some challenges there, but it drives towards, you know, attracting people into the public sector if retirement options and whether vesting periods that are 10 years help or hurt in terms of attracting that. I think those are all, you know, sort of good questions. I think you have to start with what does the entity need in order to get the services out the door and to have the highly trained, skilled workforce that's necessary to provide it. And I agree with Jeb. I think in most states, beyond outside of legislative staff or executive office staff that are appointees, most people are you know, long-term employees. They're not going in and out the door with political terms.
Picking up on the optimism in your statement question, Bob, is I think this whole system is evolving together in interdependent ways. So on the one hand, you've got employers trying to figure out how they're going to continue to operate as employers when they have an older workforce that's thinking about retirement, and they need to be creative to find ways to continue to operate as employers, and their policies will evolve, likely along lines that you're describing. Then you have individuals, baby boomers, whatever, people who are looking at their own finances, looking at their 401k balances, looking at the evolution of their pension benefits, if they have a pension, and having to make decisions about whether to continue working a little longer or retire or take a part-time job. So you have sort of decision-making that's happening there in an interdependent way. And then at the same time, you have public employers and who are thinking about the public policy evolution, how Social Security needs to respond to be sustainable, how Medicare needs to respond to be sustainable, how state pension plans need to respond to be sustainable, and the decisions they make in turn affect. So there's an evolution here that's, you know, gradual, interdependent, involving all the different actors in the system, and in the end you work through to a place that probably works. That's where I'd pick up on your sort of optimistic view that this is going to evolve and be okay.
Thank you. All right, next question. Gets up over here.
Thank you. My name is Ken Hawkins. I'm a state rep in New Hampshire and on the retirement subcommittee. I think it's fairly good job today. You know, good information. The one question I've got that I didn't hear anything about is earnable compensation. Every state does something different, whether it's unused sick time, unused vacation time, police details, on and on and on. And I'd just like to know how some of the other states address some of those issues.
Thank you. And what we're going to try and do to be able to cover more questions, if just one or two of you, if we can keep it, not everybody answer, one of you, maybe, Catherine, you've seen how some of those different earnable comp works in different states, if you get
It's definitely a big issue how that final salary is calculated and whether overtime, for example, can be included in there. A lot of, I would say most states have made rules that you can't include overtime. It is, I believe, a much greater issue at the local level, particularly with law enforcement and how much the final salaries can escalate. And one way of correcting for that is having a maximum pension. Your pension is a percent of the final.
Thank you.
Was that the question about what goes into your average final compensation? I just want to make sure I got it.
Okay.
You want to go on one thing?
I'm going to say I've looked at about 30 or 40 states. So everyone's a little different. It's how you negotiate it. Those states who have a collective bargaining statute probably have more in it than those who don't. And it's everything. And they're separated by the class, whether it's a public employee, regular public employee, teacher, for instance, and public safety. All have different ones.
Yeah. And you know, first of all, an opportune time to say it. The typical state employee or teacher in the state of Vermont that's retired in the last couple of years, pension is about $17,000 to $18,000 a year total. So we read a lot in these papers about $100,000 pensions and gold-plated, and you know the typical one is $17,000 to $18,000. The vast majority of state employees and teachers don't even have access to overtime at all. So you're talking about a relatively small amount of people in Vermont. The most recent legislation basically says that during the AFC periods on the teacher side, compensation that's going to count towards your retirement benefit can't go up by more than 10% a year during those years, which is a three-year AFC. And the state system, gosh, my guy's going to correct me. It's basically the hours can't go up more than 20% of what they were in the five-year average period before you even got into your AFC period. Is that basically right, Bob? Okay. So we've tried to address that issue somewhat. I mean, more than somewhat, actually.
Thank you. I think that's helpful. Let's move to another question. How about somebody younger?
It worked.
Thank you.
With all due respect to the representative from New Hampshire.
This worked?
Yeah. Gerald Friedman, professor at UMass Amherst, where I had a wonderful student who was nice enough to remember me. I have three remarks, which I'll put a question mark at the end so we can pretend they're questions. The first is, as regards the famous demographic bulge. And it always bothers me because people don't pay pensions. Money pays pensions. The relevant issue isn't the relative size of the working age population to the retiree population. It's the fiscal capacity, the GDP of the country. You know that. If you have the population, you know, stable, or you know, the retiree population growing, but the productivity of those who are working goes up by 1.5%, 2.5%, 3.5% a year, then these numbers look very different. And the same, of course, applies to all the states. Vermont's retiree population looks really large until you compare it to, until you take into account that, well, the retirees are still a very, very small part of the population of the state. The capacity to pay retiree pensions is much greater over time than shows up, not even getting into the issues of immigration, which you know, are systematically underestimated by the government, but we could talk about that another time. Second, the real issue is, we all know, is health. If health care costs for retirees and for everybody else keeps growing faster than the GDP, then we're all going to be I don't know what, you know, moving out of the country to countries with less expensive healthcare systems. I'm not sure, but that's where the real, as the treasurer pointed out, that's where the real issue is in the potential underfunded problem. And finally, the thing that hasn't been talked about is what those of us who are fortunate enough to teach intro microeconomics do all the time, which is diminishing marginal utility gives you risk aversion, and defined benefit plans are more desirable for people. You know, we could do this on graph. You've probably done it. Are more desirable for people than plans with the risk transferred to the individual through defined contributions. There's a reason people like defined benefit plans. It's what you would expect as an economist. And that somehow should factor in someplace in what we're doing. What we're talking about is people's retirement, and someplace we should be talking about what type of retirement plan people actually want. I'll put a question mark there. Thanks.
Why don't we just move on to another question? Gentleman here.
Thank you. My name is Brandy Brandon. I'm retired, and I'm on the finance committee in the town of Acton, about 20 miles west of here. I'd like to comment on a couple of assertions or assumptions, three of them, that were I heard this morning. First of all, 8%, 7.75%, 8.5% return on a pension fund. We have some distinguished economists there, and I would posit that returns in the financial markets have to, over some period of time, be congruent with returns in the real asset market. And 8% doesn't sound feasible in the least. Secondly, looks like an extrapolation of 1 to 2 months per year in life expectancy. Not too long ago, I listened to Tomas Philipson from the University of Chicago say that with what we bought off on in health care, we've bought off on a reduced life expectancy for our children and our grandchildren. Third, the standard of living for people having declined. I'm old enough to remember the 50s, and I guarantee you I and everybody I know is living a lot better now than they were in the 50s. Irrespective of whether they're employed, unemployed, how they're employed, I don't believe that for a minute. I'd offer, you know.
Thank you.
Can I make a comment?
Yeah, sure.
The only one I'll just quickly comment on is the return assumption, because I know that's probably a hot issue, you know, for anybody that's on an investment board or something like that, and it certainly is in our state. And we currently have, for the state and teachers, an assumption of 8.25, and the municipal is 8. And every time you move that, I mean, there are a number of factors you got to keep in mind. And I think if you went back and looked at it 3 years ago, at over a 10, 7, 5, 3, you know, 1 year basis or 20-year basis, you'd say, hey, we beat that 8% assumption in all those time periods. So, you know, when you look at it, it makes a big difference. I happen to agree that, again, looking forward, you know, the sort of macro secular trends for the next 20 years aren't what they were, and it's a bit rich right now. But every time you make a change, it has a major impact on what the necessary employer or employee contribution has to be. So what we're considering in Vermont, just to have you consider it, is to basically, since there is no magic number of 7.75 or 7.36 or, you know, 6.8, of actually we're going to be voting in a few weeks to whether we're going to sort of just have an incremental plan over the next several years of like 5 or 10 basis points a year reduction to get us down. Because the flip side of it is, in over the last number of years with both state employees and teachers, governors and legislatures have been committed to full funding of the actuarial recommendation. And we don't want to do anything that's going to give them such a big shock that they're going to say, sorry, we can't do it. So we're looking at a more incremental phase down of that assumed rate of return, that hopefully can be picked up in full employer contributions to get us down to a lower range of expectations over a period of years. I just throw that out as one state's way of looking, of potentially looking at that.
Just a couple, since one of them was one of the comments was related to the standard of living issue, which isn't I'm happy to send you a slide from a couple studies that have been done documenting a gap between wage. While productivity has absolutely been on the incline over the last 30 years, wages have been flat. So it may be true that standard of living has improved, but the lot and life of the quintiles of people in our economy, the difference between what the top 20% has gained and what the bottom 20% has gained is dramatically different, and that increase in productivity has not been equally shared as it was in the period from 1948 to about 1972, where gains in productivity were shared across all of society and has not been the case since then. So that's the comment that I was referring to. I think most of us who work with pension funds recognize that the next period of time is going to be extraordinarily challenging to meet the return assumptions, whatever they are. And at the same time, for us, in looking at this, need to try to temper motivation on the part of investment managers to figure out the next big thing to get that excess return, and try to look for, and what we're trying to think about is ways for pension funds to be and act more like what they are, long-term investors, looking for return, trying to figure out ways to do assets in the similar to what the liability stream is. So looking to try to find things that more closely mirror that rather than exaggerate the risks, which we're all too happy to take on the upside. But I think, as the professor from UMass said, we don't like the downside. We don't like to think about it, and we're not very good at absorbing it on the other side.
Can you go to somebody in the back there? If I go to each of the people with the microphones, I'll make sure we go around the room well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ken Donnelly, state senator from Massachusetts, former commissioner of the Public Employee Retirement Administration Committee, also the Senate designee to study pension reform last year. And a couple of comments. One, I think all states are not equal. In Massachusetts, the average normal cost is 12.5%, and the employer contribution is only 4%. The employee contribution is 8.5%, and the only reason it's 8.5% is because we have 5%ers, contribution 7%, and now the new employees are paying 9+2% of their contribution for pensions. So the system, when you start looking at what type of shape the states are in percentage of funding, Massachusetts is in very good shape. And again, cost of pension security is less than 4% for the state of Massachusetts total, because we're a non-social security state. So it's when I get very frustrated when we start talking about the problems with the state and municipal pension systems. In Massachusetts, we are in good shape, and we're doing it right. In some cases, I guess, the employees pay more. The other point I want to make is on health insurance, though. Health insurance, and we just I was dealing with this in the legislature, and I'm still dealing with it. I'll give you an example of our community south of here. The community is Hull. Hull just decided to go from 75-25 contribution split to retiree health insurance to a 50-50 contribution split. The average retirement in the city of, in the town of Hull, is $21,750. That's the average retirement. The contribution for health insurance for the state, for that, those retirees, will be $12,000 a year. That's their contribution. $12,000 a year, unless they want to go into a value plan, and that will be $9,500 a year with high co-pays and deductibles. Now, there was someone up there said that it's not equal, that people in the private sector don't get the same benefit as those in the public sector. Well, let me tell you what would happen if that person was in the private sector instead of public sector. That person would be eligible for the Connector Plan under Massachusetts, their health care Connector Plan, and in some cases would not pay co-pays and deductibles. But because they're a public employee or a retired public employee, they are not eligible for the Commonwealth Connector Plan, health care plan, and therefore their insurance is unaffordable, and we're setting up a system where we have retired public employees that will not be able to have access to health care when, in fact, private, if they were from private entities, they would be eligible for the Connector Plan. So we have to be very careful when we start talking about these policies that we put in and scaring people into the fact that, we have to start looking at the facts of how this process works. That is one situation where we're putting a unfunded liability on cities and towns and states for their insurers or for their retirees for health care, when in fact these people are getting health care from the state, and there is no unfunded liability. So I wanted to make those comments. That's what's going on in Massachusetts, and we need to be very careful because we do have a good system, one that will protect people and make sure that they live with a little bit of dignity, and we have to be careful when we start making these changes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee, and I appreciate your comments, each and every one of you. My name is David Lang. I'm the president of the Professional Firefighters of New Hampshire. Active firefighter in my 30th year. Just got off duty this morning at 8 o'clock, and that's why I was late, because of Boston traffic. If the Deer Center could do something about that, I'd be very much appreciative. In the media, they say if it bleeds, it leads. I understand today that's why we're here, because we have some pension systems that appear to be bleeding. I think what we've got here is a problem, and I'd like to just direct a question at the end, a problem under which we have developed a benefit structure and a benefit system that is high quality to attract quality employees to leave private sector employment to come to public sector employment. When I came on the job, I made $4.60 an hour to be a firefighter in 1980. In 1990, I made $13,000 a year. So we developed this benefit structure, yet the whole time we went along with this benefit structure, we created employer charges that were beneficial to the employers. My question is this. Well, first, on the sustainability piece, I get a little bit upset and agitated by the use of the word sustainable. If I didn't pay my mortgage, I wouldn't be sustaining my residence too long. And I think in this case here, with the employer contributions being structured in the way that they are, we've created financial schemes, actuarial smoothing, increased rates of assumption, generational shifts of the unfunded accrued liability, expectations that higher return on investments were going to be the save-all for employer contributions. And my question is this, has anyone have any thoughts about how, after Katrina, there was a great study that was done as to what happened. After 9/11, there was a study done as to what happened. Has anyone done any type of study that said, what impact have these things had, and how do we move forward without making the same mistakes?
Thank you. Would anybody like to?
I wasn't clear on what things you're talking about. All those, the smoothing and the super returns?
Actuarial smoothing smooths out the employer's contribution over a period of years based on investments. That actually has an impact on employer contributions. Generational shifts in New Hampshire in 1990, from 1993 to 2003, it was cheaper to pay into the Social Security system. Cheaper to pay into the retirement system than the Social Security system. That had an impact. Moves a generational shift of money on to this generation of taxpayers. More than anybody's done any studies as to how that impact has hurt the pension system, and how do we move forward by not repeating those mistakes?
From our stuff, I think there are probably two groups that have done the most work. One is the Pew, and the other one is the Washington State Legislature as a legislative review process. And they went through all of the 50 state pensions on the rates of assumptions, the inflation rates, the spreads, the negative spreads, et cetera. And if you looked at that, they rated by funding nature what has happened for those states over time, the same as the Pew has done the same sort of work nationally. What occurs most times is actually each state has to be reviewed individually, and that is their actuarial analysis, and they do this thing called an experience report. The experience report is the one that if you don't have done in your state, you ought to. As I indicated earlier, Rhode Island postponed it for 2 years. There was some rationale for it because of the change of health care, and there's a change of the demographics of the workforce with people leaving. But that evaluation is done on about every 3 years in most states, and what it does evaluates all of the internal items to which what is the rate of return, it's the inflation rate, wage adjustments, whether you've actually done it, retirements, lives, deaths, all of the mortality issues are in it. That's done on every three-year basis, and you'll see all of the impact, and normally it's all laid out by component change. For your state, they should be doing one as well. There's never been one that I know of who has ever taken those because they're done on different time periods. No one I've known has taken those off on a 50-state basis. The only one that's done, I think, is the GAO about 4 or 5 years ago did some analysis on pension systems across the country. And I would go back to that, but that's a dated one as well.
No. Since we're short, go ahead.
Well, Catherine. I was going to say a lot of states look both at their fair market value and at their value smoothed so that they know if their fair market value is a lot lower than their smoothed value, they know that it is likely that that the funding level will continue to drop. I mean, the effect of smoothing is that you don't get hit all at once. You get hit over time so that you'll see pension funds in almost all the states continue to drop for the next 4 years, say, as they did after the 2001 recession. The few states that don't smooth are, again, I think West Virginia, and I can't remember the third, took the hit all at once. So Oregon went down about 30 percentage points all at once.
So I would say for the sake of time that one of the most significant factors that led the private sector to pull out of defined benefit plans was mark-to-market and doing away with smoothing. And the kind of volatility you're going to get if you did away with smoothing will be a death knell of public pension plans as well. So I actually think smoothing does make sense. And I think we actually did feel the first major hit this as of June 30 last year. So I do think pension plans did see a hit of the declining market. And I also, on my mind, I think moving to 15 years, being a little bit of a cynical kind of person, I'd say I'd feel better about it if they were doing that move back when they were at the top of the market than they were at the bottom of the market. But I think it's important. I think smoothing definitely makes sense.
They actually went to smoothing in 2006.
Yeah,
15-year smoothing in 2006, which was the top of the market.
I stand corrected.
CalPERS has counted 85% of their increased contribution projection is from the market change. Again, I don't know of any studies across the United States. NEA does an annual survey of the features of various retirement plans, and NASRA, that's been mentioned earlier, also does a lot. The National Institute for Retirement Security has also looked at some of that across plans.
Thank you. Okay, we've got one final question.
Thank you. My name is Paul Donahue. I'm with the Mass Organization, State Engineers and Scientists. And I really wanted to pick up on one of the points Mr. Woodbury made and get your comments on that. Let me start by saying we did make some recommendations to the Massachusetts pension plan along that line, basically to lift the cap, we have an 80% cap in Massachusetts, at least for our Group 1 employees. This maybe would not apply to public employees. They pay their whole pension. I mean, if you retire at the age of 60 and are at 80%, you've put in 40 years and you've made enough contributions that you're actually paying 105% of your pension. You can also retire at 80% with 32 years if you start at the age of 33. In that case, you're paying 90% of your pension. Why is that so? Because they have your contributions for 40 years before you have to start spending a penny. So if you can encourage that employee who's at 80% to stay a year longer, two things happen. Number one, there's one year less you have to pay because he's going to die when he's going to die. Number two, it's 1 year later you start making the payments. But number three, often overlooked, there's one less person you're hiring and one less and one less health benefit you have to pay, because most states do pay the health benefits people retire. So there's a lot of savings that can be made by encouraging people to stay longer. And the way to do that is to lift the cap. And as Mr. Woodby pointed out, no states are doing this. So if you lifted the cap and you designed it in such a way that people would stay longer, that's the only way I know to affect current employees, because virtually every state has protection for their employees, so you all have to play around with future employees. So if you want to affect current employees, you have to give them a carrot and not a stick. And that, I suggest, is a carrot that each state should consider, is to lift those caps and do it in such a way that the employee is getting rewarded for staying longer. After all, he's not collecting his benefits for a year. So I don't see why the cap has to be, say, 80% in mass. It could be 80. 1 year extra could get you 82 or 83 another year. And there's really nothing wrong with getting it to 120% if you have to work to 90 to get it, because you're not going to live that long to collect it anyways. So I would strongly suggest that states should be considering lifting the caps. And as Mr. Woodby points out, none of them do. None of them, they all have a cap at whatever it is, 75%, 80%. None of them let the cap run higher, and none of them have actuarially figured it out that it may make economic sense to let people work longer and to actually solve the problem at the same time. If people are going to live to be 100, yes, you have to find a way of encouraging them not to think that they have to retire at 62, but do it with a carrot, don't do it with a stick. Thank you.
In fact, the trend in many states is the other direction right now, is to place caps on because, again, the headlines have talked about people bringing in, where there aren't caps, of the potential for having a pension that is more than 100% of your final salary. So, again, I agree. It cuts both ways.
A couple of quick thoughts. One, you're not paying your own benefits. So you're not contributing to get your retirement benefits. There's no doubt if an actuary calculates the cost of raising the cap, it will cost the system money, I guarantee it, because we did it. We just raised it from 50 to 60. We didn't go as far as you, but then we don't have Social Security. We do have Social Security in Vermont, whereas Massachusetts doesn't for their public employees. But, you know, that did cost the system money. It didn't cost anywhere near as much as the savings we got from raising the retirement age. So we raised the retirement age and also raised the amount that people could accrue, and the net saves the system money.
Thank you. I'm going to turn it back over to our director to wrap it up.
Thank you. I really want to thank all six of you. I feel as if I've gotten a tremendous education here. And you all, I feel as if we got the right people here, and I'm really appreciative. If nothing else, I'll be more careful the next time I read the New York Times. I'm really impressed at not only did we cover pensions, but the whole topic of pensions moved into other fields as well. Workforce incentives, health care, just how many things this touches the fairness between the public and private sectors. It does seem as if the next several years are going to be very, very tough. We're going to be facing some very difficult decisions in the public sector. And, I predict that 5 years from now, pensions will look very different, and the mix of services that we get from our state and local governments may also look very different from what they are today. Serious, serious issues ahead. I want to make one last plea for filling out the forms. If you don't do it here, take them with you, think about them, and do it electronically. I thank you very, very much for your participation.